Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to say boys and girls because if there's boys and girls listening, you need your heads checked. Well, maybe for a good reason. Hopefully it's a good reason, but I'm prejudiced because it's my program. This is Jake McClure, and this is another episode of The Personal Wealth Coach. Usually Jeff McClure would be joining me. He is recovering still, but he's getting better. Sounds like a Monty Python line, but he is. He's getting better, and I saw him very recently. He is upbeat. He's looking great. He's lost a lot of weight. So good news is that he'll be returning to the program at some point. Bad news is that you're going to have to deal with me until then. Ha! Bad news for you. All right, so what is the Personal Wealth Coach? We are an SEC-registered investment advisory firm most of the time. That just means that we function as fiduciary advice givers for investments and other things of financial matter. And it's also a radio program, obviously. You're listening to us. So what I don't do on the air, it's something you should all know, so I'm not going to give anybody individualized investment advice. A big part of what we do is recognizing what the interests of the people we give advice to are. How's that for a weird sentence? If I don't know what your interests are, giving you advice would be like trying to recommend what type of car you should purchase without knowing what you're going to use it for. If you say I have $100,000 to invest in a vehicle, well, you have a choice between some Porsches, BMWs, or dump trucks. They have different uses. So understanding what your needs are comes before any advice. That's just kind of a caveat here. I know a lot of call-in radio programs, you ask them, what should I do? And they say almost blanketly, do these things. Well, I can give you some generalized stuff, and that I will be doing. So let's start with what we normally start with. What's happened this week? Well, as is usual, the week started with a Sunday, unless you're my dad and believe that all business weeks start on Monday. Anyway, because he doesn't believe that the week should begin on a weekend. But I respond generally with every end is a beginning. So Sunday, I believe, is the beginning of the week. That's what happened this week. We had a Sunday all the way through today, a Saturday. What's happened in the market? Not much. Even on the days where it moved, it didn't move very much. So the end result this week is that the S&P 500, which started, it ended the week at 2,169, which is 0.68% below what it was last week at this time. That's less movement than a normal daily move. So what's the end result of that? Not much. I've got a caller calling in right now, so I'm gonna talk to the caller. Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I enjoyed the program and the newsletter. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal on three miscues from the Fed. I was just curious if you'd like to weigh in on that, and is the Fed's confidence and credibility at risk? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Good question. I was going to get to this, so it's a good time to do it. Part of what I was going to say is that we had a weird week in that the market didn't move much, even though Janet Yellen made some statements at the annual meeting at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that would normally have caused the market to drop. The Federal Reserve's job is almost impossible. So let me say that at the beginning. They've been given mandates through different laws that say that they're supposed to, number one, protect the currency power, the buying power internally of the United States, so to make sure that the dollar doesn't inflate too much or deflate too much. That's the number one goal. Since then, they've also been given some other mandates by Congress, which become very, very difficult. One of those mandates has to do with unemployment. Well, the Federal Reserve has very few tools in that particular toolbox. They've got some, but not as many as they should if they're going to be given a mandate. And the other one is to keep the volatility of the stock market to a minimum so that when they make their statements, they're not causing the market to crash or to jump based on rumor. That's a harder one as well because they have a lot of power in that area. The caller asked about three miscues. Because of all their mandates, they have to be really careful. First, they have to warn the market if they may be doing something way ahead of time. Because one of their mandates, again, is to prevent too much volatility, too much bumpiness in the market. And people, if you recall, doesn't seem that long ago, but if any of the boys and girls are listening, it's a very long time ago. But back in the time of Alan Greenspan, he could rub his nose the wrong way and cause the market to do something absurd, either up or down. It was kind of irrelevant. When Janet Yellen, who's the current chairperson, I guess you can't call her a chairman, of the Federal Reserve, Federal Open Market Committee, when she makes a comment, she and her predecessor, Ben Bernanke, made a big point of giving some of the background information that they use to make their decisions in going into these meetings. They would give it publicly to the market. So I'm kind of laying in the background of what is it that they do. When the Federal Reserve raises an interest rate, in the case that most people are talking about, it's the interest rate that banks have to pay for an overnight loan from the Federal Reserve. Banks have these reserve requirements because they have your money in them, and the Federal Reserve says if they've got your money in them, then they've got to have some money on hand in case you want your money. Now, they're not required to have all of the deposits on hand. That would be absurd. They wouldn't be able to make any money off of your deposits. They wouldn't be able to pay you any money on it. So the reserve requirements are very real, and at the end of every day, this is part of the reason why bankers have bankers' hours. They kept the bankers' hours even when computers showed up, which is a little bit absurd. But bankers' hours are there because throughout the history of the United States in a bank, you've got lots of loan officers. And they're not talking to each other instantaneously all day long to say how much money they've loaned out. So at the end of the day, they've got to close their doors and they've got to calculate how many loans they made and make sure that they haven't given out too many loans for their reserve requirements. If they have, they've either got to go to other banks or to the Federal Reserve to get some money. So having a low interest rate at the Federal Reserve means it's easier for them to give loans. That's the idea in the stimulus. If you're a business person and you want to go get a loan, the bank has a good way of getting extra money at very low interest to give you that loan if they want to. Now, they've had other problems in giving loans having to do with losing money, having lost whole amounts of loans. So that's a different story. But when the Federal Reserve is talking about raising or lowering an interest rate, if in this case they've been talking throughout the year about raising rates, and they've done it once, well, the predictions that they made back in June, they said we may raise interest rates. And then we had a strange oddity in the unemployment numbers and the new job numbers that came out in May. So the Federal Reserve wanted to make sure that that was a fluke instead of a trend. So they didn't raise interest rates in June when they were warning that they would. This goes back to that other mandate about volatility in the marketplace. When they say, we maybe will raise interest rates, and most people would think this is about as interesting a subject as watching paint dry. Well, listening to my voice hopefully makes it better. Somehow I don't think so, but maybe, hopefully it does. When they give that warning, when they say, hey, we may be doing this, we're looking at these figures and it's leaning us in a certain direction, they're doing that so that the market doesn't move around too crazily when they actually do the thing that they've been talking about. Well, the last three times that they said we're looking at something and we're kind of leaning in that direction, they haven't moved on it because new information has come out. That makes a lot of people in the media and people that aren't really sure what the mandates of the Federal Reserve are say they're just calling wolf, or they're just messing with our heads. They're looking at information that's coming out up to the last minute before their meeting. What I can tell you for sure is that interest rates will rise. When is a big question, but they will rise. Now, how can I get away with saying that? Because it's either that or our country kind of ceases to be what we've known it to be for our entire history. People just stop growing the economy. And we're seeing growth in the economy. All of the numbers that I'm looking at are saying really good growth. We're also seeing some productivity drops. Okay, so why would the Federal Reserve raise interest rates? Let's get to that first so that we're not being jerked around by what the headline says. Why would they raise an interest rate? Well, they want to prevent too much inflation. Well, what causes inflation? Well, when we have a lot of people employed, a lot more people than usual, we have a lot of people employed. And that counts for right now. And we've got pay going up to the people that are employed. Some of that is pay to new employees, and some of it is increased pay to existing employees. So we have more money being paid, and we're seeing that in all the numbers everywhere you look. ADP does a great report on this. They're much more accurate than the government in many ways because they're measuring the payrolls that they're actually paying. ADP is a big payroll company, and they pay payrolls for a lot of companies. So they can measure what's going on, and what they're seeing is that pay is going up. Other numbers are saying that productivity has dropped. That is very, very normal at this point in a hiring cycle. And I can look at two numbers and explain that very quickly. When we're hiring more people, productivity always drops. The reason is because the people that were doing all the work before, they can see an end in the future. Other people will be helping them. We're hiring new people. So they're going to either have an assistant or they're going to have somebody else that can help them do what they were doing before. But between now and then, they've got to train that person. That person is worse than not having someone there right now. It's actually lowering productivity to have a new trainee on hand. And anybody that's ever worked in any business or any company anywhere knows this to be true. If you're training an employee, you don't have time to do all the things that you would normally do. And we're training a lot of employees in our economy. So the end result of that is that productivity drops. So let's think of it in the manufacturing context. Say you're building a widget, and widgets are, I'm not even sure what widgets look like. Everybody talks about widgets because it's a really good name for nothing. Say you're building a prototype for a new machine. And this prototype, it's almost done, but you've got to stop to teach the software that you're using to develop the CAD software, to develop this prototype to somebody else who's coming on. Now, you've been working 12 to 15 hour days, and you've got this new person coming on board. At the same time that the new person's coming on board, you're getting a little raise, which is nice. That's what we're seeing in the numbers. It's nice. You've been working really hard for a really long time, and you haven't seen much of a raise at all. But now unemployment's down, new job hiring's way up, which means that the competition for hiring has gone up, which means people don't want to lose their employees. They got to give them some raises. So they're giving them a raise for doing not as much as they did before. Now, everybody understands that that's not a common sense approach. We recognize that these people are capable of doing more, but that we've just given them a task of training employees. What that means is that the price has just gone up for an item that's less valuable. I know that's a weird thought, but when productivity goes down, say you were making two items in a day, two of these prototypes in a day, and now you're making 1.8. The pay just went up to you, which means that the company either has to raise the price on the item that they're selling, which the consumer then has to pay for, or they're cutting into their profits. Companies would rather raise the price than cut into the profits. So prices go up for the same item. This is the process. We're not seeing the prices go up yet. It's not hit the stores, but it will, because we know this process. It's happened countless times throughout history, and we've finally gotten to a point where we're actually looking at history when we make decisions on interest rates. So as hiring goes up and productivity goes down and we get close to full employment, whatever that means at a given time, it's pretty normal for inflation to start kicking in. The way to get ahead of inflation is to raise those interest rates that we were just talking about so that loans are a little bit harder to get, so that you don't have easy money lying around to give more raises. It makes businesses work a little bit harder and employees work a little bit harder to get the raise. It does tend to raise productivity. Anybody that was around for the 80s, the early 80s, and I was around, though I wasn't taking pictures of anything at the time. I was pretty young. What happened when Carter was no longer president and Ronald Reagan became president is that interest rates went up. Volcker raised the interest rates, and he did it to head off that double-digit inflation that we were seeing during Carter's era. And let me wipe some boards clean here. That caused a recession. Did Ronald Reagan cause the recession? No. Did Jimmy Carter cause the inflation? No. There's absolutely nothing they could have done to prevent or cause either of those things at those points. The normal economy caused those things, and the presidents happened to be there when it happened. So when Volcker raised interest rates, he raised them drastically, which cut ahead of the inflation trend, and we were able to keep inflation down. Now, we're not seeing inflation tick up too fast right now. We're starting to see it, though. The numbers are starting to show positive inflation, which is not something that we've seen very much of since the beginning of the Great Recession. When that happens, the Federal Reserve's job is to try to get ahead of it so we don't get runaway inflation. It's very easy for the banks who now are hiring bankers that weren't around during the housing crisis. It's very easy for them to start making decisions that don't have that, to some of us, very fresh memory in mind. So the fresh memory of losing lots of money in loans, that was almost alliteration, losing loan, yeah, okay. Losing lots of money in loans is something that banks don't like to do. When they give a loan, they really want it to be paid back. And they went through a period where a lot of people weren't paying back their loans. So that caused a lot of the older bankers who were possibly young at the time to say, hey, I'm going to be really, really careful about who I give the loans to. As the economy has gotten better, as new hiring is picking up, the banks are starting to release some of that money. We're seeing it in housing starts. We're seeing it in existing home sales. The loans are starting to flow again. That's an important factor. It's very important because those loans are going to cause a little bit of inflation in the environment. That's pretty well where the inflation comes from. If you just got a pay raise and you've been waiting to buy a house, so we're going to use that same person making the prototypes. You've been working 12, 15-hour days. You've now training somebody else. You've been saving up for a house. You don't have 100% of the house paid for before you buy it. Maybe you have 20 or 30% of it as a down payment, and that's a pretty normal down payment these days. So you go to the bank and you say, I've got 20 to 30%, and they look at you and they say, hey, you've got a good job history. It doesn't look like any layoffs are going on right now. You've got a lot of money to put down on the house. Okay, we're going to give you the loan. Well, if a lot of those loans happen, then a lot of spending takes place. There aren't a lot of construction workers out there, which means that they have to be paid more to work on any given place. That's the nature of inflation. When you get paid more to do the same job, that's what inflation is. When a dollar is worth less than it was because the thing that you're buying is more expensive, even if it hasn't changed at all. So when the Federal Reserve says, we're going to be raising interest rates in the near future, believe them. Even if they say maybe we'll do it in June and they don't, believe them. Dr. Fisher and Dr. Yellen have both, and Dr. Fisher is the vice chairman, and Dr. Yellen is the chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee, the Fed. They're both saying, yep, we're raising interest rates. Dr. Fisher has just said that it's possible that we'll do it twice this year from here on. That'll be three times this year. This is at the same time that the European Union has been, their central bank has been lowering interest rates because they're still hovering right at recession. They're not seeing huge job increases. They've had a steady trend in most of the places, but there's really big areas where they haven't had that trend at all. It's gone the other direction. So those three miscues that the caller was talking about what the Federal Reserve might be doing or might not be doing, the Federal Reserve's job is not to confuse you. They do that job pretty well, but that's not what they're paid to do. Their job is to let you know what they're thinking before they do it. And if new information shows up, to be flexible to that new information. All the information that we're seeing right now is really positive for the economy and even more positive than it was before May when they were saying maybe in June we'll be raising interest rate. It's more positive because we've had a lot more hires. We're seeing productivity drop and we're seeing pay go up. All of those things say interest rates are going to go up too if the Federal Reserve just does its job. So don't worry so much about what the media is saying about Janet Yellen calling wolf. If it's wolf season and she says wolf and everybody else that knows how to look at wolf signs sees wolf too, it's not just calling wolf because she's daydreaming. We're going to get some interest rate hikes and expect them to happen and you won't be surprised. The reason why they're giving the big warnings is so that we can expect them to happen so we won't be surprised and cause some kind of weird thing in the market. All right. I'm going to play some commercials. And on the other end, I'm going to get back to what I had planned to talk about. That was a really good call, and I was planning on talking about that, probably not in as much detail. Hopefully, I've filled in some of the gray areas, the misty background, the smoke-filled dark rooms that people think of when they think of the Federal Reserve. It's really pretty clear. You just have to read a lot of documents to understand what their mandates are. They have a clear mandate, a series of them. Sometimes those mandates contradict each other. And when that happens, you get what the media is calling Yellen calling wolf. I think they've missed a headline there. Yellen yelling wolf would have been a better one, but hey, I don't write headlines. So I'm going to play some commercials. The other end, I'll be back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call during the commercials or after, the number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I'll be back.
It's the Chevy Summer Sale.
And as promised, I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in and add your 2 cents to my penny's worth, then you may get some change. The number in here is 254-773-1400. All right. I've got some interesting bits of data here. When I say that the economy is doing well, people kind of either they feel it in their own lives and they say, yeah, I'm getting a pay raise, or I'm seeing business pick up, or yeah, there is a lot of traffic on the highway. But how much of that is due to road construction? How much of that is real? Let me tell you where some of this comes from. The measurement on after-tax profits on companies that are traded publicly is very easily available. They all have to get audited and they all have to post it. It's part of our regulatory environment. When that happens, we get to study it. The regulatory environment is there, by the way. Why should a company be required to post their profits and their taxes and all that good stuff when we don't even require a presidential candidate to post their tax returns? We just highly encourage them. Well, it's because we don't generally buy a candidate unless you're, well, maybe these days we buy candidates. Okay, we don't legally buy candidates, but we do legally buy companies. And when we do that, we need to have the best information available. So that data is there. When measured, what we see is that since the beginning of the fourth quarter of last year, so we're talking about September-ish, since the beginning of the last quarter of last year, so we'll call it the end of September going into beginning of October, corporate after-tax profits are up about 14.3%. That's huge. That's a really massive increase in profits. In a very short period of time, it's almost been a full year. It's getting close. We've got another month or so, but it's not been a full year, and they're up 14.3%. Okay, so why is it that people are still saying we're in a bubble? People are saying there's a problem. Well, here's why. After-tax profits are still down about 8%. Even though they're up 14.3%, they're down about 8%. From the year before that. So a two-year period now, over that two-year period, we're down 8% even after being up 14.3%. So we were down a lot more in the profit side. Okay, what caused that? I just gave two completely conflicting pieces of information. I'm saying the economy's in good shape, but we're down in profits 8% over a two-year period, but up 14%. And okay, this is confusing stuff. Bear with me. The reason why the profits dropped so drastically was almost entirely due to oil. When the price of oil dropped, because a lot of people were bringing oil to the market in the United States, it was a booming business. It was a business that was causing a lot of the growth that we were seeing at the time in the economy. Industrial output was way up because they were building rigs, because they were building pipelines, because they were building the things that people were using to get the oil out of the ground and to the market. Refining every aspect of the industrial output. And then take another step further, the railroads were at maximum capacity because we don't have enough pipelines. So then we have to put the oil in tanks and put them on rails. Well, then they increased the capacity of the railroad. The railroad could then hire more people, and charge more for their services. With the drop in oil prices, we're seeing a lot less of that. So if you take out oil as a part of the economy and put it to the side for a second, what we're seeing is a very positive over that two-year period. And the fact that the overall economy, the overall after-tax profits for corporations, after taxes, they're up 14.3% over a year. That's even with the price of oil being down. That means the rest of the economy has been doing double duty to pick up the slack left by the oil industry. We're in great shape. I said last week that the number of rigs is up for oil as the price has come up a little bit, which puts a ceiling on the price of oil because there are enough people out there just waiting to turn the oil back on at the different drilling facilities, the different wells. Not sure you should call it a well when we're talking fracking because it's not the same kind of concept, but we still call them wells. So these rigs, these wells, we've got less of them. They're being more efficient, but they're ready to be turned back on if the price gets to a certain point. That keeps the cost down for the rest of the economy. Everybody else, you and I included, get to do more things for less money. That's one of the counteractions against inflation right now, that our economy growing as fast as it is, it's even growing faster than normal at this point. And this is one of those things we've been predicting it a long time. It's nice to, you know, my shoulder gets wrenched out of socket every once in a while as I try to pat myself on the back. This is one where my shoulder's been sore for quite a bit. We've been talking about this year, 2016, this point in the year, for about 5 years, because all the numbers have been indicating that the growth that we're seeing today was going to happen. We said it, and if you go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, you can look at podcasts from 2 years ago and 3 years ago and listen to them, and you will find that we were predicting what we're talking about right now. It's not rocket surgery. We're just looking at the numbers and what they mean. It's kind of like if somebody's in an airplane to Los Angeles and there's nothing wrong with the engines, then it's pretty easy to predict where they're going to land. I have a running joke with my wife when I'm driving and she's giving directions. I have the running joke that she says, you're going to turn left up here in about 3 miles. I call her a psychic. Because in certain technological environments, that would be a somehow superhuman ability to tell me where I was going to turn before I did it. But there's knowledge behind it, which means it isn't psychic. And that's the same thing that's going on when we're talking about growth in the economy. So that growth that we're seeing is another trait to make you expect the Federal Reserve to raise rates in the near future. Everything besides oil has been on a steady growth curve. We've got manufacturing up. We've got real estate being sold. We've got, you just go down the list. Even manufacturing, which was hit so hard by oil, it's growing net of the oil losses. If you take oil out as an industry, we're seeing growth unlike anything we have seen since about the 1920s in manufacturing. That's insane. We're seeing it because a lot of new things are coming out, a lot of new ways of doing things, and that's going to lead me on to my next subject. But I've got to play some more commercials before I do that. So I'm going to go ahead and start the commercials. I'll be back on the other side, and I'll talk about some of the new things that are coming out, some of the things that are causing the growth in the economy, and some of the things that will cause the growth that nobody even talks about right now for the future. There are also some dangers out there that you need to be aware of. So if you would like to call in, the numbers are the phone number is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back.
I'm Nick Soboleski, a SelectQuote agent with a true story that could save you hundreds of dollars a year.
rp.org/caregiving, a public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The number in here to call is 254-773-1400. I said I was going to talk about some of the new things that are out there, some of the dangers, some of the things that are going to lead to growth, and some of the things that may lead to disaster. Things to keep in mind. There are always threats, and there are always the precursors to great things. We need to understand them if we're going to make good decisions. So what is it about the economy right now that is ultra hot? Let me say these things. I'm not going to give advice as far as purchasing things, but in the biotech world, in the manufacturing world, in the in areas that we don't even have a name for properly, there are new innovations and new devices that are coming out that are completely game-changing, completely life-changing. There are massive events in the work. They're coming. Uber is going to be putting 100 self-driving cars in Pittsburgh as soon as this month. And this month is still going. I mean, we're not that much left of it. We're talking about either the end of this month or the beginning of next month. 100 self-driving cars will be ushering people around in Pittsburgh. Now, they're going to have drivers. They won't be driving. They'll be sitting. There's going to be two people in the front seat. They're Uber employees, fully paid salaried employees of Uber, not the contractors that are the normal drivers. Their job is to be there for safety for the testing purposes. They've got hands near the wheel. They've got their feet near the brake or the accelerator, all that stuff. They're not going to be taking chances on this in Pittsburgh. But it's the future. There's a startup named Ottoman, and I'm using them as a startup name because they are one of probably two dozen right now that are working on the same kind of project. Ottoman is building hardware to put in existing vehicles, specifically 18-wheelers, to make them self-drive on the highway. And one of the slowdowns that we were seeing ahead as the self-driving vehicle came out is that we would have to still go through the normal inventory change of, you're driving a car, you're not going to stop driving a nice car that you like tomorrow just because another car comes out that can drive itself. Well, the technology is coming to make existing cars drive themselves. It's coming. It will be here. It will be the norm. And when that happens, a lot of truck drivers are going to lose their jobs. That's not good news if you're a truck driver. It's not good news if you know a truck driver. This is a profession that's been around indirectly for thousands of years. The people that drove the trucks of the past, truck doesn't mean the engine, by the way. Truck is those sets of wheels. And truckers were people that were running wagons. The Teamsters Union still exists, and the Teamsters Union hopes to have lots of truckers in the union because Teamsters used to run animals that were pulling trucks. And we've just applied the same name to a new technology and say this big truck is on the road. That's going to happen. When it does, the people that have those jobs are going to lose them. They're not being exported, they're being replaced. This is something that is vitally important to understand, to plan ahead, to get ready. A lot of the truckers, the average age for a trucker has been going up for a long time. So this may coincide very nicely with the retirement of a lot of the trucking industry. It's part of the reason why it's being developed now, because the people that are running the trucking businesses, the ones that are looking for new drivers, have been begging from their knees for years now. Anybody that's watched late night television has seen the ads, truckers needed. Those ads haven't gone away, and they won't go away until the technology's there, because they need more truckers right now. But it's not a long-term career path. This is a path where we see the end, and it's not that far in the future. I have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You think maybe they'll have trucks that can unload themselves eventually and, you know, like luggage that will carry itself?
Absolutely. I do. It just depends on how far in the future you're talking. The idea of a truck, when it gets to a place, the idea of it unloading itself is not that difficult to see. Amazon's already got machines that are loading trucks. They're doing it themselves. They're moving their warehouse stuff from one part of the warehouse to another and loading them up onto trucks. They're loading them up into airplanes. Right now, the constraint is unloading, because you don't have a facility in place at each unload location. But it's going to happen. The portability of these machines is going to be there. Now, we're talking a decade or so out for that stuff to start hitting. So this is what I mean, where we can see the end. The technology is beginning. It's already being produced. It's hitting the roads. In Europe, they've already had multiple caravans of driverless trucks go across the entire continent, actually carrying goods. And when they get where they're going, people are there to unload them. It's a lot easier to hire local labor to come and unload a truck than it is to hire somebody to drive thousands of miles and then unload the truck.
Airplanes have been flying themselves for a while.
Yep.
Even though they still have pilots in them for safety reasons.
Right.
What bothers me a little bit is, I believe Ford is cranking out these cars with no steering wheel and no brake pedal and no gas pedal. And that, to me, is a little iffy. I'm not sure I'd want to, especially in these early stages, like 4 years from now, I'm not sure I'd like to call Uber and a car with no steering wheel, no brake pedal, no
right,
and no driver in it at all. I'm not sure that people are going to actually, you know, it's going to be something that people are going to have to get used to.
That's correct. And what's going on with Tesla is saying that there's already a big segment of our population that's ready to be getting used to it. They want to be used to it. They're ready for the computers to take over. Now, that is going to spread slowly.
Unfortunately, it's not going to be quite as fun as we think it is at first.
Right.
I mean, it's not like, oh, great, I can just sit here and drink a beer while I'm driving or riding.
Right.
Uh, they're going to have regulations out the wazoo.
Yeah, and those regulations will slowly be eased, but the regulations are only just beginning right now. One of the things that is important to recognize is that the governmental regulatory authorities are behind the power curve drastically here. They've got some preliminary laws that are pretty draconian about what happens out there, as they should be, because there's the possibility of having really big danger on the road. But at some point, and you said this, airplanes have been flying themselves for a long time. They've been flying themselves with very, very limited programming. An airplane flying itself is not a lot different than what people used to do 300 years ago with sailing vessels, where you would tie the wheel. You tie the wheel and nobody has to be standing there. You know, if you're on a fixed course, you tie the wheel, you check the wind, you make sure you're not drifting off course occasionally, and you're in good shape. And that's what the pilots are doing on the autopilot. They're double-checking the instruments to make sure that the autopilot isn't set to the wrong location. The airplane is said, I'm going to fly in a straight line here to the next point that you say I need to fly in another straight line. It's not making decisions. Somebody else told it this is what you will do. Cars don't have that luxury because there are a lot more cars on the road than there are airplanes in the sky, and the roads are a lot smaller as far as the size than the sky. You don't have three dimensions to dodge each other in. We have just the flat, open ground, and when you leave the road, things get really bumpy. There is no road in the sky. So it's a lot easier to have kind of dumb autopilots going up there. We have to have really smart ones on the ground, and you're right, it's going to take a while for people to start trusting it, but the take a while is going to happen a lot faster than we think, just like it did when automobiles came out in mass. As long as they were a one-off thing that just a few people could afford to own, people were like, I'm nervous about those automobile things, those vehicles are scary and they scare the horses, and what are people going to do when they get stuck, and what if they run out of gas, and all those questions were out there. As soon as they started being mass manufactured and the price was low enough that people were able to use them regularly, it became normal almost overnight. And that's what we should expect to see at any new technology, just like with computers. People were saying, I don't know about these computer things. And some people still do, but they own a computer when they say it. That concept that everybody is aware of something happens very, very quickly. Now, it may take a long time to get to that point, but once it hits, it's like, what did we do before this? If you think about smartphones, well, I don't know if I like a company knowing all of my phone numbers or knowing all of my friends. Well, we've gotten pretty used to that pretty fast. There are some dangers involved there, but we've gotten used to it, and we definitely need to be dealing with those things. There's still some threats there. But don't expect, because this new technology is here and we're nervous now, the reality is that airplanes don't crash that often. And cars that are being self-driven in the companies that have them out there don't crash that often either. They crash a lot less often than humans do, even at this really early stage. And this is baby talk stuff for when we're talking about autopilots and cars. Baby talk.
But when they do crash, I mean, they don't do it very often, but at least one of them was pretty bad.
The Tesla crash is a great example. Tesla has band-aided to all the people that buy their car, and all of the states have said if you're driving a Tesla and you have it in the autopilot mode, that you need to have your hands on the wheel and your foot near the gas or the brake, because it's a new technology and we don't trust it yet. The guy that died got sheared by a semi-tractor trailer that was crossing the road in front of him. Now, that semi-tractor trailer was breaking the law to cross when it did, but the Tesla was speeding, and the guy that was supposed to be watching the road was watching a Harry Potter DVD in a portable DVD player. So there are safety features that the computer runs that seem to be working really well, but when it's human-controlled safety features, those are where the problems are. And I'm sorry, I'm getting close to a hard break. I've got to let you go. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. All right. All right. If you would like to contact me off the air to ask questions, or we actually do manage portfolios for high net worth people, the number to call to get voicemail during the week and real live people during the week, I'm sorry, during the weekend, and real live people during the week, is 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email me directly, Jake at tpwc.com. Until next hour.